So we got to running through that summary. And then the kind of next step in His Holiness's structure is looking at seeing the interdependence of phenomena. And so because everything appears in our experience or seems to our senses and consciousness to exist independently, separate from their own side, etc., even though they don't exist in the way that they appear. We, and if you remember when I was talking about that grand illusion of consciousness in the way that it's transparent, Thomas Metzinger's idea of transparency, that we see, we're not aware of it, we see right through it, but what we're seeing right through into is what the mind's doing. Transparently and mistakenly assume and believe that everything exists in a much more substantial, concrete, black and white way than it actually does. And when we do that, we're drawn into afflictive emotions, kleshas in Buddhist terms, sort of creating seeds of suffering, both for ourselves and others. And so we want to prevent and undo this by reflecting again and again on the dependent nature of everything. You know, the proposition is, if you can first of all understand that idea with the mind intellectually, but using the English or Western sense of the term mind rather than the Buddhist Gita one, and internalize it and really for it to become an experiential reality, then there's some possibility of breaking the cycle. Yeah, because although appearances won't immediately change, you'll see them for what they are. And just seeing them from what they are will liberate you from the attachments and aversions that attach to it prior to seeing it for what it was. So all phenomena, everything helpful and harmful, cause and effect, arise and come into existence and are established in reliance on other factors. And there's another quote from Nagarjuna, this time out of the Precious Garland of Advice. And it says, when this arises, that arises. Like short, when there is long. Mm-hmm. Due to the production of this, that is produced. Like light from the production of a flame. So in the context of dependence, everything can function as it does. Actions and their effects take place. We and everything else in the world are not just figments in our or somebody else's or some supreme being's imagination. It's not a nihilistic view. And dependence on thought doesn't mean we're just mental creations, but the idea that we or anything else is wholly independent, not dependent in any way, existing from its own side, is a figment of the imagination. So it's a completely fantasized way of existing because nothing would ever actually exist like that. So it's important not to assume the exaggerated notion that phenomena or things in the world exist independently, exclusively under their power from their own side, or the exaggerated idea that we don't exist and deny the functioning of cause and effect. You know, otherwise, to your point, Nauri, it would make a nonsense of karma. Yeah, so karma still applies. His Holiness, actually quoting from here, said, falling into the chasm of exaggeration, we're drawn into satisfying a conception of ourselves that exceeds how we actually are, an impossible feat. So realizing that phenomena are dependent arisings avoids the extremes of dangerous denial. Realizing that they're all empty of inherent existence avoids the extreme of dangerous exaggeration. And if you go back to the original first sermon of the Buddha, and why Buddhism is called the Middle Way, is because he was outlining a middle way between nihilism and eternalism. There's also another level at which he was outlining a middle way between self-mortification and hedonism, but that's a kind of another level of it, if you like. But at the philosophical level, it's a middle way between eternalism and nihilism. So he's saying if you fall into the chasm of exaggeration, we're drawn into satisfying a conception of ourselves that exceeds how we actually are, an impossible feat, realizing that phenomena are dependent, arisings avoids the extremes on the one hand of dangerous denial, realizing that they're empty of inherent existence, avoids the extreme of dangerous exaggeration. So the realization of emptiness as it's directly experienced in non-dual meditation, we've already been there, can't be adequately expressed in words, but that doesn't mean that emptiness can't be reflected and meditated upon. And that's where we've got to. I'll hold it there, because where we're going to go from here is actually into saying, okay, let's see how we can meditate and reflect on the emptiness of the self in this sense, in a practical way. But I can go a little bit there before, because we've got 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes before dinner. So what I might do is kind of just gently lead an analytical meditation. So if we want to find a comfortable posture, this will be a sort of a weigh-in. It'll be a discursive weigh-in, but it's really just about following it gently, turning it over in the mind, thinking about it, letting it sink in. But you're first opening up to it and then using it as a seed for, well, is that right? Is that not right? Is that how it is? It's that kind of reflective meditation. It's prefaced with, of course, right back to the Pali Canon, a saying of the Buddha, who said, just as a chariot is verbalized in dependence on collection of parts, so conventionally a sentient being is set up depending on the mental and physical aggregates. So the Buddha taught that there's no self, that we're all selfless. Kind of, it's one of the things that's kind of unique to the teaching of the Buddha. But however, if you feel, if we feel that we are here, right here and now, with all our parts, mind and body, surely you are indeed here with your body and mind, in, of, and by yourself. You are self-existent. You exist here and now in yourself. So there does indeed appear to be a self. Don't we already naturally feel this way? Don't we feel that, of course, we have to exist in that way? That we have to exist by ourselves? What do you mean, no self? What about me? That very feeling is the feeling of inherent existence. It's the one that Buddhist teaching is saying is the very opposite of the way things may actually exist. Yeah, if we do feel that way, we're making progress, because at least we've successfully identified that sense of self, which is the one that appears to exist in a way that it doesn't. We've got a clear target, as it were, and we're noticing a very basic appearance. It's undeniable that all phenomena, including ourselves, habitually appear to us as if they exist from their own side, but we don't yet realise fully that it may be a false view. Still, noticing that you feel yourself solid, real, something that doesn't depend on other things, and not just imputed or designated by consciousness, although possibly a false view, could be helpful. If you base yourself on what actually and undeniably appears, you're reaffirming the own thingness of yourself, the very thing being denied by the Buddhist view. Sometimes referred to in the technical meditation manuals as the object of negation. Nevertheless, valuing this direct experience roots us more in the very stuff of appearance and less in thought, and makes it easier to understand and appreciate what actually is being refuted, denied, and negated here. The seeming establishment of a strong sense of yourself, somehow inherently and independently existing by way of its own character. When you get down to experiencing this level of being able to ascertain the appearance of yourself and objects as if they were established from their own side, if you're a Buddhist, there may be a struggle, for it seems that Buddhism is wrong, since it refutes this undeniable feeling that I am right here and with all my parts, mind and body, in and of myself. But without this initial step of getting into your own experience, recognizing and perceiving directly what is actually appearing to you now as yourself in your meditation, you can easily treat the, quote, absence of inherent existence as merely an abstract topic, and perhaps even feel sure that it's correct without ever really understanding its implications at an experiential level. Unless this becomes more than an intellectual understanding, actual progress on the path is going to be difficult. The question is, what does it mean to be an object? What does it mean to be? We mistakenly take it to mean that a phenomenon in some way governs or covers a certain field that is its basis of designation. This is the way we live. This is the way things appear to us. This is not the way things are. Mind and body, the individual parts, the whole, and the parts over time are our bases of designation of I, what we refer to when we say I, but are not actually us, and we are not in them. Even if these aggregates or bases of designation do have certain qualities, such as consciousness, etc., they still don't have the prerequisites for being called a person. The qualities are suitable to be the basis of the designation of a person, but they're not the person. In this view, a person is posited by thought, independence on these qualities. when we experience or conceive of ourselves as inherently existing, we don't analyse whether this sense of ourselves as an inherently existing person and the mental and physical aggregates that are the basis of designation are the same or different. We just conceive and experience ourselves as inherently existing out of a natural conditioning to do so. At the coarsest level, we can consider ourselves to be permanent in the sense of not changing, unitary, in the sense of being partless and independent, in the sense of not depending on the mental and physical aggregates. If we question and reject this idea, perhaps by thinking about time, death, impermanence, and the relationships between parts and wholes, then usually we still consider ourselves at least as a self-sufficient, substantially existent entity. Usually, no matter what appears to our minds, it seems to exist from its own side, independent of thought. When we pay attention to an object, whether it be yourself, another person, body, mind, or material thing, we accept how it appears, as if this is its final inner real condition. When criticized for something that we've not done, we have the very strong experience, I did not do that. When you forget something important, you can get angry about your own mind. Oh, my awful memory. Then the I that is angry and the mind at which you are angry appear to be separate from one another. When upset about some aspect of your body, the same thing occurs. The I that is angry seems to have its own being, in and of itself, distinct from the body at which you are angry. This I seems to stand by itself as self-instituting, as if established by its own character. This I does not appear to be set up or just arise independence on mind and body. Whenever we do something, either terrible or something wonderful, a strong, particularly obvious, concrete, and vividly clear sense of I appears. And there's a good quote on this from the fifth Dalai Lama. This is his words. Sometimes the I will seem to exist in the context of the body. Sometimes it will seem to exist in the context of the mind. Sometimes it will seem to exist in the context of the feelings, discriminations, or other factors. At the end of noticing a variety of modes of appearance, you will come to identify an I that exists in its own right, that from the start is self-established, existing undifferentiated with mind and body, which are also mixed like milk and water. This is the first step, the ascertainment of the object to be negated in the view of selflessness. You should work at it until deep experience arises. And I'll stop there, because that's the first step in the sense that we talk about things not existing in the way they appear, including the way we appear to ourselves, but it's difficult to make it experiential and get it away from the intellectual unless you can identify in your own experience what that one is. So that's the one to reflect on, and it's worth reflecting on, and I might not, well, certainly won't now do the second step until tomorrow, which I think is a good thing, because you can think, ah, can I get a feel for that one? What is that one? So there's 10 minutes or so for the gong will go, so if you want to...
So what's that eye called?
Huh?
The real eye, what's that one called?
The
real eye.
Um, it appears real to us. It appears to be self-existent. Yeah, it's the one that, you know, it's like, I hear the idea that there is no self. And the initial reaction has to be, well, come on, here I am. Tell me about it. Why haven't I got a self? So we go through the arguments about, well, actually, nothing kind of exists in that way, wholly from its own side, separate from the mind and body. Yeah. And the sense of I arises independence on the mind and body. It's correct for me to say, I, here I am, I'm over here. But if I think there's anything more than what you're looking at and what I'm feeling, there isn't anything. But there's a tendency in the way we perceive that to think there's something more, you know, in the sense that I can say, oh, my awful memory. I'm really terrible at that. Or I'm really good at this. Or I really don't like my body. Or I'm, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. Or it can, there can be positive things as well. That one that keeps saying I, somehow there's a sense that that's separate from the rest and not dependent on it, not related to it. And that's the one we mistake as that when we're usually either getting angry or feeling very proud of ourselves. That's the one that we think, well, that one's undeniable, isn't it? That's the numbskull, the one who's in the centre controlling everything. Yeah, the ego would certainly be a part of it. It arises independence on the ego. And if the ego become, a healthy ego is really, really useful. I don't know how we could live without it. We need one. But if we think it's an inherently existent, inflated ego, then it's very difficult. Difficult for us and everybody else, no? So yeah, the ego is a good label, but again, it's another label. It's this one I'm trying to get you to think, what is it in me that comes up when I talk about I, not in an intellectual experience, but this subjective experience. Neither I nor anybody else can give you that one. You have to kind of identify the reference for yourself. All true, but you. If I say, I'll be with you in a minute, if I or anybody else says, okay, the way self appears to you in its manifest ways, the way it appears, it doesn't exist like that. We remain at an intellectual level unless we can actually identify it in ourselves in its various forms. You're absolutely right, but it's not an intellectual description we're looking for. How does it actually... Yeah, that's what it is. So yeah, this first step is kind of identifying that, not in an intellectual way, although you need a little bit of a grip. But then to actually say, well, yeah, how when I do have a strong sense of I, how does it arise?
Yeah.
What are the causes and conditions that make it come up? And that's why the tradition tends to go for either strong negative feelings or strong positive feelings, because that's when we have a strong sense of it. But of course, you know, it comes up and goes. I mean, you can notice it in particular with anger. You know, if anger really rears up, then it's really, really strong. And it's, you know, I'm going to kill that person. I'm never going to speak to them again. It was really horrendous. It may be 48 hours before we can calm down and see clearly. And then 48 hours later, it's not quite as strong as we thought it was. And then we say, oh, yeah, I really went over the top there. I didn't have to say that, did I? You know, and then 36 hours away, it's barely recognisably the same person. And you might even want to go and say sorry. Or you might say, I'm just going to leave it there. Or whatever. But when it comes up, that one is so strong, so self-existent, so undeniable, so sure, so solid, so concrete. And there's in that moment, there's no possibility of tomorrow or change or whatever. That's a very extreme example, you know, when anger arises. But if you then try and think back, well, there's lots of other, as the fifth Dalai Lama was saying, sometimes, you know, it arises on the body. You know. Could be like, it's not at the moment, but I'm very, very comfortable. But I could say, the pain in my knee is really, really awful. I'm really in pain. And then I'm just that. It's really, really solid. There's nothing else. There's no possibility of saying, well, actually, gently change your posture and get up if you need to. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's actually getting into the, trying to get experientially into the viscerality. And of course, there are intellectual parts to it.
Mm.
There are physical parts to it, emotional parts to it, exactly as you said, all those behaviours. But to actually feel it, to actually start to try and recognise it. In the tradition, some people have got an ability to say, I kind of know how I feel about myself now. I know where that one is, yeah? But some people might say, no, I don't get it. So you say, well, think about a time when somebody falsely accused you. Think about a time when you were very angry. Think about a time when you were really, really happy. Think about a time where you achieved something, you know, the sort of sports person's air-punching moment. And then think about how that feels. And then we're getting close to the one that's being spoken about. As we go on from here, might just particularly, if you let it go, just as you're going about your business, see if what pops up. See if you can identify that one. Because that's the one to work with. Yeah, it is the drama queen. Yeah. And the other way I like to think about it, it's the emperor in its new suit of clothes, no?
Yeah.
But it's actually naked. That's a very good point. It is. It's a very good thing about the ego too, isn't it?
Yeah.
A healthy ego is really, really important.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's unhealthy if we think that it's inherently existent, dominant, all there, you know, whatever. Sorry, two.
Oh, no, you can go
up. Where I sort of...
I thought, well, that one for me, I'd kind of say, well, for me, that's starting to get unhealthy. But what about the ego that says, I want to organise so that I can train myself and my mind to be of maximum benefit to other people?
Yeah.
But that little organiser that doesn't really have any inherent existence, that arises, that ability to organise, that becomes what, in any psychology that I can understand, will be defined as the ego. Yeah. If it's directed to, and we have to be careful here, because what's unwholesome for you and what's wholesome for me may not be quite the same, but I think we can probably find some overlap and agreement. That's quite healthy. But if it becomes totally self-obsessed, totally self-cherishing, only thinking about itself, and it becomes inflated to the point of narcissism and complete lack of respect for anything outside of it, then it's wholly unhealthy. No, it's really unhealthy. But the idea that liberation means the elimination of the ego altogether is kind of crazy, because without the ego, as I understand it, I wouldn't be able to live. I'd be a mess. You know, that there's that organizing principle, and the one that prioritizes and does things and all the rest of it. It has a purpose. It hasn't even, you know, it's evolved. Evolutionary biologists would give us a good account of how it evolved and why and how useful it is. But again, if the way it appears, we think it exists in the way that it appears and then exaggerate it, problems. Is that helpful? Yeah, maybe it's about exploring ideas of the ego. Thinking, we've got the word, the ego, we've got a rough idea. No, I understand. Yeah, I understand. I understand. It's never been that way in mine. I've thought, I can... Because when when I came across it, the bell's gone, so I must go in a minute, but when I first came across it, I had this idea of, there's a sense in which nobody can function without one of these. It's not really not possible. So why is it that... it has a very bad press, then you think, we see why it's got a bad press. And then those things are addressed. But when I first came across it, it didn't have this idea that everything about the ego is bad, so therefore it has to go. So I think that's what I'm saying. There's dialogue, if we kind of explore different perceptions and ideas of the ego. Anyway, it's dinner time. Sorry to keep you.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a great discussion.